Disc 28.
The first requirement was that Southern support be stripped away from Stevenson. That would be accomplished by Johnson's entry into the race. The second was that both Stevenson and Kefauver be stopped, preferably that they kill each other off. The third was that Johnson position himself to be a candidate. And there was an additional urgent requirement, that Johnson do so without becoming a candidate openly. An announcement that he was running would rouse Northeastern Democrats and liberals across the country, distrustful of him because of his past pro-Southern positions, to organize a Stop Johnson movement and effectively destroy his candidacy before the convention so that he would not be able to become a compromise choice there. His effectiveness as the Democratic Senate leader would be undermined as well, as Tommy Corcoran was to explain. If his colleagues thought he was pushing all those programs to get a track record for a presidential race, they'd scatter every time he called a caucus. He should go to the convention, he decided, as Texas's favorite son candidate. That way, his name would be placed before the convention, but in such a fashion that he could claim he was not a serious candidate, but was only trying to hold his state's vote until its delegation determined which of the other candidates to support. And to make sure he held the delegation's vote, he decided, he should also be its chairman. By coincidence, the perfect opportunity to implement this strategy was immediately to hand. That already scheduled visit, just 5 days after Eisenhower's heart attack, by Adlai Stevenson and Sam Rayburn. The visit had originally been thought of, by both Johnson and Stevenson, as little more than a courtesy call. Now, however, there were consequential matters to discuss. Johnson wanted them discussed in secret, but someone in Austin learned that Stevenson and Rayburn would be going out to the Johnson Ranch after the speech, and George Reedy had to telephone Johnson from Austin to inform him that a large contingent of reporters could be expected the following morning. Johnson's reaction was rage, an old-time explosion that could be felt all the way to Austin, that was so violent that Reedy started being afraid that he was going to bring on another heart attack and die, and that didn't subside for hours. At midnight, Reedy got another call, from Lady Bird, just begging me to keep the press from going out to the ranch. She was just crying. Apparently the people out at the ranch were like a family would be during the Black Death in Europe. Explaining that while reporters could be barred from the ranch itself, that's private property, nobody could keep them from standing on the public highway right outside the gates and talking to people going in and out, he advised her to allow them on the ranch instead of letting them use their imaginations as to what happened. Rayburn, Grace Tully, along for symbolism, Stevenson and Stevenson's aide Newton Minow, arrived about 11 o'clock at night, expecting to find a man recuperating from a heart attack already asleep. Instead, he was waiting for them in front of his house. And the discussion among the three leading figures in the Democratic Party, held on the porch under a huge hill country moon and a sky filled with stars, lasted until well past midnight. Among the subjects of discussion was how to handle the press the next day. The reporters, Johnson said with his usual hyperbole, think that you, Adlai, and you, Mr. Sam, and I are here plotting to take over the government while Ike is dying. We're not going to let them do that. And the next morning was, to Reedy, who had spent a very worried night, another Lyndon Johnson paradox, with his boss the most gracious of hosts. Coming out onto the front porch at 6:30 a.m. while his guests were still asleep, Johnson found a crowd of newsreel, newspaper, and radio reporters on his front lawn. "Are you going to throw me off, Senator?" Dave Chevens asked. "Of course not," Lyndon Johnson said, with a laugh and a broad smile. Walking over to his station wagon and saying, "Hop in," he took a half-dozen reporters, with the others following in their own cars, on a 40-minute tour of the ranch. When they returned, Stevenson was outside, and Johnson beckoned him to come over to the barn, then walked ahead of him, noticeably faster than usual with his long strides, so that Stevenson was forced to trot to keep up. He loaded Stevenson into an electric golf cart, in which the two men zoomed along the concrete walk, past the herd of white-faced Herefords near the river, and when Rayburn emerged from the house, the three men had a Texas ranch breakfast. Orange juice, Pecos cantaloupe, scrambled eggs, bacon, venison sausage, hominy grits, popovers, and coffee. "Please," said Stevenson after the meal, "let's skip lunch." Then they sat down on three chairs on the lawn, the journalists crowded around, and a press conference was held. Rayburn didn't do much talking, sitting with no expression at all on his face, declining to smile for the cameras, and Stevenson wasn't required to do much either. When, asked if he thought Texas would return to the Democratic column in 1956, he started to reply, Johnson cut him off. "I think Mr. Rayburn and myself are in a better position to answer that question," he said. "Texas will be in the Democratic column." "Who am I to contradict?" Adlai said, with a smile. When, at the end of the conference, a reporter asked Stevenson if he was planning to return to Texas, he said, "I'd like to come back to Texas and either talk or listen, whatever they'll permit me to do." All three men said that they had agreed not to take advantage of President Eisenhower's illness. Johnson and Stevenson said the visit had been just a purely social call. Stevenson had the grace to make the statement with a slight smile, which seemed to suggest that everyone there knew he was saying what had to be said. And when pressed on whether any politics had been discussed, he said, "I'm in the presence of politicians, and it is possible the talk may have reverted to politics." Johnson, however, insisted that his statement be believed. "It was a purely social visit with an old friend," he said firmly, and his elaboration on this point was summed up by time. "No politics had been discussed," said Johnson, "and as far as he was concerned, none were going to be. The visit had absolutely no relationship to any political situation arising from Eisenhower's illness." The visit had not been purely social, naturally. Stevenson had been pointedly advised by Senator Johnson, as William White was later to report, that he must contest Kefauver in at least one or two state primaries in order to prove he was more popular. This course might well lead Stevenson into a trap in the light of Kefauver's demonstrated skill in that type of campaigning, White noted. Should Stevenson fail to score heavily in the primaries, he then would be only one of several candidates and no longer the odds-on favorite at the convention. Aware of that danger, Stevenson told Minow on the flight back to Chicago that, "I'm not going to do it. If the party wants me, I'll run again, but I'm not going to run around like I did before to all those shopping centers like I'm running for sheriff. The hell with it." Johnson's advice, however, had been accompanied by a subtly worded warning about what might happen if it was not followed. In White's phrase, if Adlai entered the primaries, no all-out Stop Stevenson movement would be likely to arise at the convention. And in the event, the advice was followed. Texas's powerful and reactionary governor, Alan Shivers, had expected to be chairman of the state's delegation, but Johnson had on his side the only man in Texas capable of breaking Shivers's hold on the state. And Sam Rayburn was willing to do so because, he believed, Shivers had in 1952 committed the sin that was unpardonable to this man to whom there are no degrees in honorableness, you are or you aren't. He had broken his word to him, promising to support Stevenson, and then throwing the state to Eisenhower. After Stevenson left the ranch, Johnson apparently told Rayburn — Rayburn was shortly to repeat the conversation to Tommy Corcoran and Jim Rowe when they visited him on his ranch in Bonham — that he knew he couldn't win the Democratic presidential nomination, but that he wanted to try for it at the convention so that he would be in a stronger position to get the vice presidential nomination, which would put him ahead of the field for the top spot in 1960. Feeling that Stevenson had the nomination sewn up and aware of the depth of liberal antipathy to Johnson, Rayburn was not enthusiastic about Johnson's candidacy, believing it would split his beloved party after fate, Dwight Eisenhower's heart attack, had handed it a chance to retake the White House. Although he had little more respect for Stevenson than Johnson did, he wanted a short, harmonious convention. In addition, loving Johnson, he didn't want him running so soon after his heart attack. But, loving Johnson, Sam Rayburn knew what Lyndon really wanted. Not for a minute, Corcoran and Rowe understood, did Mr. Sam believe that what Johnson was aiming for was the second spot on the ticket. And he knew how much he wanted it. He agreed to help. Rowe was to write Johnson in a very confidential letter that, at Bonham, "He spoke of you, as he often does to me, with a certain amount of pride in you, and also with some hedging, like an overfond uncle who thinks his favorite nephew should get a lot more spankings than he does." Rayburn told the two Washington insiders that he had regretted agreeing to Johnson's proposals as soon as he left the LBJ ranch. He made it clear that he wants a quick convention giving the nomination to Stevenson, so that the Democrats don't get themselves in a first-class row. He felt that you were making a serious error in forming the Southern Coalition because it meant that you would become the prime target of the Northerners. And Rayburn told the two Washingtonians that if what Johnson wanted was really the second spot, he, Rayburn, could get it for you by himself and without any trouble. Tommy Corcoran asked him how he would do that. Years later, Tommy the Cork would recall Rayburn's reply. "Sam just looked at me for a long time and said, 'I will go to him, Stevenson, and ask him for it.' But it wasn't what he said, but the way he looked when he said it. That was the end of that conversation. I thought, God help Adlai if he tries to take on Mr. Sam." In his contemporaneous letter reporting the conversation with Rayburn, Rowe, who was not given to reporting facial expressions, wrote Johnson that Rayburn had said he would go to Stevenson and demand it, and he knew he would get it. But he had agreed to Johnson's proposals, had given his word. Shivers was loudly vowing to fight for the delegation chairmanship. Sam Rayburn simply said to reporters, "Lyndon will be Texas's favorite son for president at this year's convention, and he will also serve as chairman of the Texas delegation to that convention." And that was the way that, after a brutal fight, it turned out. The reaction to Dwight Eisenhower's heart attack emphasized to Lyndon Johnson the gulf between where he was and where he wanted to be. The fact that while a Senate leader might be big news in Washington, and to some extent in New York, he was decidedly less big, indeed not even particularly well-known compared to the president, in the rest of the country. The Dow Jones Industrial Average plummeted in its most disastrous day since the crash of 1929. Losses were estimated at more than $12 billion. There had not been a tremor in the stock market on the news of his own attack. He had been so proud that the number of letters and telegrams he had received had eventually risen to 7,000. The White House received tens of thousands of letters and telegrams every day. Bulletins about the president's condition were on newspaper front pages day after day. His cardiologist, Paul Dudley White of Boston, became the most famous physician in the country, his every pronouncement analyzed and reanalyzed by columnists for clues as to whether Ike could run again. Question: is your answer yes? Dr. White: I would say that it is up to him. Question: did you say he would be physically able to do it? Dr. White: oh, yes, but many things are possible that may not be advisable. If I were in his shoes, I wouldn't want to run again, having seen the strain. After an Eisenhower press conference on January 8, 1956, newsmen would conclude by 4-1 that Ike would not stand for re-election. Not until later that month did the president begin to hint that he would run again. And all during that fall and winter of 1955, the jangle of telephones and the clatter of typewriters were not the only additions to that still, quiet Pernalis landscape. There were plumes of dust in the air, fast-moving plumes from cars carrying visitors from the Austin and Fredericksburg airports to the LBJ ranch along unpaved hill country roads. The flow of visitors increased. Russell, Clements, Symington, Fulbright, Price Daniel, George Smathers, John Connolly, Bobby Baker. So many that Reedy could tell Johnson that his ranch had become his party's political capital. Polls were telling Johnson one story, Gallup's reporting that Stevenson was the favorite of 39% of Democratic voters, Kefauver of 33%, Harriman of 6%, and Johnson of only 3%, several other polls listing him only among the other candidates favored by less than 1% of the respondents. A survey of Democratic county chairmen showed him far behind Stevenson and Kefauver, even among the 573 chairmen in the South. In the rest of the country, he was the favorite of hardly any county chairman at all. Of only 4 out of 567 in the Midwest, of only 6 out of 214 in the West. And of the 142 chairmen in the East, not one preferred Lyndon Johnson for president. But he was telling himself another story. The backing and filling around the candidacy of Adlai Stevenson is by this time not merely obvious but blatant, Doris Fleeson wrote. Its basic cause, of course, is that the Democrats now think they can win, but not with Stevenson as the candidate. If the South's county chairman were not solidly behind Johnson, the South's senators were. and other elements of a southern border state western coalition seemed to be falling into place. Asked during a visit to the LBJ ranch if Oklahoma might join Texas in making Johnson a favorite son, Senator Bob Kerr replied that, outside of football, there is no state Oklahoma would rather go along with than Texas, and no subject on which it would be easier to reach agreement. Montana's Mansfield said it was a reasonable assumption that Johnson might become a figure around whom Southern and Western Democrats could rally. Here on the Johnson Ranch is where the Southern Bloc is being organized, Richard Strout wrote in the New Republic. Before the Roosevelt Revolution, the South had a two-thirds convention rule that gave Dixie something of a veto power over the candidate. Now the effort is being made to organize the same device, in effect, through the offices of Senator Johnson. White wrote in the Times that some of the Democratic professionals are maneuvering to gain for the South and conservatives generally an extraordinary and conceivably even a decisive influence on the Democratic National Convention next year. The unofficial and unlabeled headquarters for this effort is the LBJ Ranch on the Pernalis River. The reaction of Democratic liberals, growing resentment in a Times phrase, to these reports reinforced Johnson's conviction that they would organize against him if he became an open candidate, and his denials were piously emphatic. Attacking unjustified presumptions in the press, he declared that his ranch has not been a meeting place for discussions or evaluations or planning the strategy of any Democratic nominee, and added that it would be unfair and improper for a trustee of the party to set himself up as a kingmaker. Corcoran had come to the ranch bearing the offer of a substantial gift from a man who had the power to make one, Joseph P. Kennedy, Sr. In a meeting in New York, the ambassador instructed Corcoran to tell Johnson that if he would publicly enter the race for the nomination, and would privately promise that if he won, he would select Jack Kennedy as his running mate, Joe Kennedy would arrange the financing for the ticket. If Johnson was not running, the ambassador said, he would support Stevenson. This offer revealed at least two drastic underestimations on the ambassador's part. First, about the extent of Johnson's own financing, and second, about Johnson's political acumen. No sooner were the words of the offer out of his mouth, Corcoran saw, than Johnson understood the reasoning behind it. Old Joe Kennedy was betting that Eisenhower would run again, in which case he would, of course, win again. The Democratic vice presidential nomination would give young, relatively unknown Jack Kennedy the national recognition he needed to give him a running start at the 1960 presidential nomination. And it would be more desirable for that candidacy to be on a Johnson rather than on a Stevenson ticket. Adlai, old Joe felt, would lose in a landslide, and an overwhelming defeat would be attributed partly to the Catholicism of his running mate, a belief which would damage Kennedy's chances in 1960. Johnson, the ambassador believed, would lose, but in a much closer race. Johnson didn't believe that Jack Kennedy would have a serious chance in 1960. He never said a word of importance in the Senate, and he never did a thing, he was to recall later. And the young senator was also, in Johnson's words, obviously seriously ill. Malaria-ridden and yellow, sickly, sickly. But there was no point in improving Kennedy's chances, and it was important that his own candidacy in 1956 not be made public. Lyndon told me he wasn't running, and I told Joe, Corcoran recalls. Joe then telephoned Lyndon himself, making the same offer, and was turned down. Johnson was to recall telling the ambassador that, I did not wish to be a candidate. Young Bobby, Robert F. Kennedy, was infuriated, Corcoran was to recall. He believed it was unforgivably discourteous to turn down his father's generous offer. Jack, Corcoran was to recall, was more circumspect. He called me down to his office. Listen, Tommy, Jack said, we made an honest offer to Lyndon Johnson through you. He turned us down. Can you tell us this? Is Lyndon Johnson running without us? Is he running? Of course he is, Corcoran replied. He may not think he is, and certainly he's saying he isn't, but I know goddamned well he is. I'm sorry that he doesn't know it. He did know it, of course. He was running harder than ever, so hard, in fact, that his doctors, worried, tried to slow him down. When Dr. Kane did not hear from Johnson for 3 or 4 weeks, he understood why. I am sure his reluctance to write is related to the fact that he knows I might fuss at him for doing too much. He is doing too much and thinking too much. And finally, on November 19th, he wrote him, "Lyndon, you have come along very well following this heart attack, and as I have said all along, I have every hope that you are going to be completely all right. But," he said, "I just want to offer a word of warning and a suggestion that you slow down some." But they couldn't slow him down. One of Reedy's memos had spoken of a need for Johnson to demonstrate that he was back in the saddle again. The phrase caught Johnson's fancy, and he provided the demonstration by returning to the national stage with a speech, his first since his heart attack, in the little Texas town of Whitney. As he appeared on stage, a band struck up the song "Back in the Saddle Again." The speech announced his program. He called it "A Program with a Heart," get it, for the upcoming congressional session, a list of 13 proposals which he said would be submitted to the Democratic Policy Committee, in the hope that they can be brought before the Senate, considered and acted upon by the Senate. 12 of the proposals were acceptable to liberals: broadening of Social Security coverage, increased federal funding of medical research, school construction, highways and housing, for example, including the one civil rights proposal that Southerners would tolerate, a constitutional amendment to eliminate the poll tax. The 13th, listed as number 7 because Johnson believed that if it was buried smack in the middle of the list, it had its best chance to escape notice, was the price he was paying for the Texas conservatives' support. A natural gas bill that will preserve free enterprise. Johnson said that, of course, the bill would also provide protection to consumers. A number of editorials noted that, as the Baltimore Sun pointed out, on a good many of the issues the Republicans have already been there, and somehow liberals managed to find and understand even number 7. Senator Johnson's "of course" will not be accepted by many of his colleagues in the Senate, who feel that the 1955 Johnson natural gas bill was just a gimmick to make Texas gas millionaires richer at the expense of northern consumers, the Washington Star commented. On the whole, however, his return from death's door was greeted so enthusiastically that Dorothy Nichols, mailing a packet of press clippings to the ranch, wrote, "It looks like in the eyes of the press and the nation you have reached a spot where you can do no wrong. How fine." Johnson had said repeatedly that he would defer a decision on resuming the majority leadership until after a complete checkup by Dr. Hurst at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta on December 14th, and then by a team of doctors at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. But he couldn't wait. More and more senators, Kerr Scott of North Carolina, Humphrey, Stiles Bridges, were coming to the ranch, as were television executives and lobbyists like Scoop Russell of NBC, and when they returned to Washington, they reported, as Robert Albright wrote in the Washington Post on November 27th, that Johnson is talking in terms of the same personally run floor show he successfully conducted last year. Delegations of authority will be few. To friends who inquire if he is well enough, Johnson retorts that he would rather wear out than rust out. And the private meetings grew only more numerous. Day after day, Pilot Reg Robbins would put down on Wesley West's landing strip, where no unwanted eye could see, and keep the engines idling. The big white Lincoln Continental would pull up, and the tall, gangling figure of the majority leader of the United States Senate would climb out and climb aboard, and the Brown and Root DC-3 would take off for the quiet conferences in 8F in Houston or in the messy suite at the Fort Worth Club or for Fort Clark or St. Joe. And at least once, on November 29th, Robbins headed west to California, where Lyndon Johnson gave a speech before the American Hotel Association. "The Democrats will take everything from the courthouse to the White House," he predicted, then met in the Beverly Hills Hotel with a representative of Howard Hughes, with whom he was on a hard-cash adult basis, and who had to be made to understand that $5,000 a year wasn't what was needed now, that real money was going to be required in 1956. And on the way back, the DC-3 made a stop in Las Vegas to see Hughes himself. The private maneuvering behind the Senate scenes intensified, too. In late November, Estes Kefauver arrived at the ranch, where, on a hunting trip with Johnson, the Tennessean got a 10-point buck right through the heart at about 300 paces with a rifle with a telescopic lens. Outwardly, all was friendliness, but Unknown to Kefauver, Johnson was taking steps to deny him the position from which he was hoping to garner publicity during the upcoming Senate session. Judiciary Chairman Harley Kilgore had promised Kefauver the chairmanship of the subcommittee to investigate monopolies, which Kefauver could use to investigate the Dixon-Yates contract. But now, Drew Pearson reported, Johnson laid down the law to Kilgore. If Kefauver was given the subcommittee chairmanship, Judiciary's budget would be cut to the bone. So caught up was Johnson in the race he was running now that, once again, as for most of his life, dates meant nothing to him. Trying to set up a conference with Adlai Stevenson or his campaign manager, Tom Finnegan, he scribbled a note to Stevenson. "I'd like to see you or Finnegan on December 25th. If there was a reason that the December 25th page in his appointment book had been blank, the reason didn't seem to cross Lyndon Johnson's mind. There was one additional reminder of his youth that autumn, the 1955 Homecoming Day celebration of Southwest Texas State Teachers College at San Marcos had been named Lyndon Johnson Day, and the college's most illustrious graduate gave the principal address in Cecil E. Evans Auditorium, and afterwards sat on a reviewing stand as floats, decorated by fraternities and sororities, chronicling his triumphant political career, passed by. Johnson's feelings on that day may not have been solely of triumph, however. On the platform with him were the two former deans, Tom Nichols and H. E. Speck, who had with razor blades cut out of every copy of the 1930 college yearbook, The Pedagogue, they could find, the pages that referred to Bull, for bullshit, Johnson, and that set down in print other aspects of his fellow students' disdain for him. Also on the platform were several fellow members of the class of 1930 who had used that nickname freely to Johnson's face, and whose feelings, in some cases, had not been blunted by time. The member of the class selected to give a talk about Johnson was Vernon Whiteside, who took delight, every time he met Johnson, in reminding him of mean tricks he had played or elections he had stolen during his student days. Also on the platform was the college's librarian, Ethel Davis. She was the sister of Carol Davis, daughter of the richest man in San Marcos, whom Lyndon Johnson had courted avidly with a determination to marry for money so unconcealed that the Pedagogue had mocked it in print, but whose father had held the Johnson clan in contempt. Carol Davis, who had broken with Lyndon because I knew I couldn't go against my father's wishes. On December 11th, 3 days before the definitive medical checkups, the DC-3 took off from the Wesley West airstrip, but not to either Atlanta or Rochester. Lyndon Johnson, accompanied by his wife, cook, masseur, dietitian, and chauffeur, was flying to Washington. He had dinner at 30th Place with Richard Russell. The next day, Gene Williams drove him down to Capitol Hill, the first time he had returned there since his heart attack, and he held a standing-room-only press conference attended by 125 reporters. The reporters were astonished by the transformation in Johnson's physical appearance. Tanned, trim, he weighed about 170 pounds, about 55 pounds less than he had weighed the last time they had seen him, and handsome. He seemed bursting with energy and confidence. Edward J. Milne of the Providence Bulletin, who interviewed him in G14, described how Johnson sat with his feet crossed on the desktop as if to prove how relaxed he is, but with a frequent tapping of fingers on chair arm hinting at all the old restless tension. Before the press conference, he had met with Senators Murray, Mansfield, Hayden, and Anderson, with lobbyists Clark Clifford, Corcoran, and Rowe, and with columnist Fleeson. After the press conference, he met with Justice Douglas, then had dinner with Averill Harriman. Only then did he fly to see his doctors, accompanied by Reedy and Russell, and talking presidential strategy all the way. After examining Johnson, the doctors reported that he had fully recovered. "Senator Johnson is now active, and his reactions to activity are normal," they said. "His blood pressure is normal, his heart size is normal, and his electrocardiogram has returned to normal." They said that they had advised Johnson that extraordinary pressures and abnormal tensions should be kept to a minimum, but that so long as he maintained carefully regulated hours of work and rest, the senator could resume the leadership. Two aspects of Lyndon Johnson's life changed during the 6 months he spent recovering from his heart attack. One was his relationship with his wife. He had asked her never to leave his bedside until he was out of danger, and she hadn't left. "Every time I lifted my hand, she would be there," he was to recall. After he left the hospital, Ruth Montgomery was to write, Lyndon could scarcely bear to have Bird out of his sight. On the ranch, Mary Rather says, whatever Lyndon did, Lady Bird did with him. How she managed to run the house, attend to her children, talk to visitors, and still take care of her husband, I sometimes wondered. Chores that took her away from him were done while he was sleeping. Whenever he woke and asked, where's Bird? She was always near enough at hand to answer for herself, here I am, darling. Their daughters, Ms. Montgomery was to write, sensed a subtle change in their parents. They seemed closer to each other than ever before. Of course, what happened, it deprived the girls even more of her presence and her motherhood, George Reedy was to say. I think they spent almost all of that time with Willie Day. Wherever they spent their time, Ms. Rather says, they weren't there at the ranch a great deal. An exception was the trip to California, on which the Johnsons took Linda and Lucy along, and where they spent a day with them at Disneyland. The girls had the time of their lives, Ms. Rather says. And as Lyndon recovered on the ranch, Lady Bird was happy, happier than anyone could remember her being. I never saw a woman more obviously in love with a man and more obviously grateful that he had been rescued, George Reedy says. In her face you could see it. I remember once when we were walking down the path, she just reached over and gave him a quick hug. You could almost feel the joy bubbling in her veins that he was still alive. I think she forgot and forgave all the times that he'd made life miserable for her, which he did very often. Among the hundreds of letters from strangers to Lady Bird was one from a woman who wrote that some of the happiest days of our lives were after my husband's heart attack. At the time she first read the letter, Lady Bird was to recall, she was puzzled by what the woman had written, but later she was to recall, I came to understand. Her every thought seemed to be for his comfort and peace of mind. She would tell guests at the ranch to laugh as much as possible. Lyndon liked people to laugh, she would say, and to be careful not to say anything about how loosely Lyndon's clothes hung on him. She knew how susceptible he was to the dispositions of those around him. There was no longer any resistance to his suggestions about her own clothes. I begrudge making a career out of clothes, but Lyndon likes bright colors and dramatic styles that do the most for one's figure, and I try to please him, she was to say. I've really tried to learn the art of clothes, because you don't sell for what you're worth unless you look well. Accompanying him on his diet, keeping him on it with soft-voiced diplomacy, to his demand for a banana one afternoon, she said, "Let's each have half a banana." She herself reduced her weight from 132 to 114. The only task she undertook without success was the one Lyndon's mother had failed in when he was a boy, to get him to read books. She was finally reduced to doing what Lyndon's mother had done so many years before, find a portion of a book she felt would be helpful to Lyndon, and read it to him, in the very small doses which were all he would tolerate. Jim Rowe, familiar with Lyndon's reading tolerance, sent Benjamin Thomas's new biography of Abraham Lincoln to Lady Bird with a note. "Because Lyndon has a lot to learn from Lincoln," he wrote, "I am sending it to you, not Lyndon, with instructions that you should read it to him for 1/2 hour a day and no more." Lady Bird replied that, "I promise to siphon as much of the most significant parts as I can to Lyndon, choosing the opportunities whenever they come along." She collaborated with her husband in concealing what he wanted to conceal. Because her first excuse for her absence at Middleburg, the fact that she had stayed in Washington for Lucy's birthday party, emphasized that Lucy's father had not stayed, she changed the excuse, telling journalists now that she had stayed because Lucy had a slight fever. She helped him to create the image he wanted, telling journalists that Lyndon's illness had given him time to read and that he has been rediscovering the printed word in magazines and books, that he had no presidential ambitions. "I firmly believe that he does not," she told journalist Irwin Ross. "If he does have such ambitions, they are so subterranean that I don't know about them." And now, gradually, Lyndon Johnson's treatment of Lady Bird began to change. Not that it became, by normal standards, considerate or even polite, but he began to allow her a role in his life, the life from which he had so largely excluded her ever since, in 1942, she had proven she could be effective in it. Politics was Lyndon's life, not mine. The see-you-later-bird dismissals continued, but now only when the politics under discussion was very pragmatic. More and more, for other discussions of issues and strategy, she was allowed to remain. So long as other politicians were in the room, she sat quietly, concealing her thoughts. After they had left, however, and she was alone with her husband and perhaps an assistant, he began to ask for her opinion. And Booth Mooney noticed that more and more, when she gave it, he listened to her. He was particularly observant of her opinion on how a speech or issue would play to the general public. "Somebody else can have Madison Avenue. I'll take Bird," he was to say. He began to praise her publicly. During interviews with journalists, he would, more and more often, point to her picture on his office wall and, as Irwin Ross put it, deliver some tribute to her wit or wisdom. Even at home, although he still ordered her in the old bullying tone of the past to run the most menial errands, more and more his orders to her would have at least a veneer of courtesy. And in response, Lady Bird changed, in a change that was slow but sure, and would eventually be so complete that it would amount to a transformation from the shy young woman who had once been terrified of speaking in public to the poised, dignified, gracious Lady Bird Johnson whom the American people were to come to admire in later years. If ever a woman transformed herself, deliberately, knowingly, painstakingly, it was she, Mooney was to say. A modest, introspective girl gradually became a figure of steel cloaked in velvet. Both metal and fabric were genuine. When she was seated on a dais, her face, while her husband was speaking, would still be tilted upward and toward him as unmovingly as ever, and her expression would be approving. But it was not long after their return to Washington in December 1955 that she began, when her husband had been haranguing an audience for a long time, to slip him little notes as he stood speaking. And once, Mooney, picking up a note after a speech, read with astonishment the words she had written. "That's enough." Then Mooney began to notice that the notes appeared to have an effect. Sometimes, after receiving one and glancing at it, Johnson, about to launch into another area of discourse, would visibly check himself, thank the audience for its attention, and sit down. And once, when a Lady Bird note had had no effect, Mooney, from his vantage point on the dais, saw something even more astonishing. Lady Bird reached out, took the tail of Lyndon's jacket, and tugged at it, and soon afterward he stopped talking and sat down. And there were other signs of the transformation. When, at cocktail parties, Johnson began pouring down scotch and sodas at his old methodically intensifying rate, she would say a quiet word to him. Once Lyndon replied that, "My doctor says scotch keeps my arteries open." "They don't have to be that wide open," she said with a smile. Her encouragement and reassurance were constant and extravagant. Once, not seeing her at a public function, he demanded, with something of his old snarl, "Where's Lady Bird?" And she replied, "Right behind you, darling, where I've always been." At a conference at which he became agitated, she slipped him a note. "Don't let anybody upset you. You'll do the right thing. You're a good man." The change in Lyndon Johnson's treatment of Lady Bird did not extend to sexual fidelity. Until the guest house at the Johnson Ranch was completed near the end of 1955, Lyndon's guests and his secretaries and assistants stayed in the 5 bedrooms on the 2nd floor of the main house. Johnson made frequent nocturnal visits to that floor. During one visit, Corcoran and Rowe were sharing one of those bedrooms, and both men recall that, in Rowe's words, "Next to us was a bedroom in which a good-looking girl was sleeping." As the two men were preparing to turn in for the night, they heard footsteps, clearly identifiable as Lyndon's, coming up the stairs and going past their door to that bedroom. They heard the door to that room open and shut. Later, Johnson barged into their room, exchanged a few sentences of idle conversation, and left. The next day, Roe, Lyndon, and Lady Bird happened to be swimming in the new heated pool together, and Roe, without thinking, said jokingly, "You know, a guy with a heart attack isn't supposed to be climbing so many stairs." Lady Bird asked Lyndon, "Were you up on the second floor last night?" Roe recalls, and suddenly, realizing his mistake, "I almost sunk under the water with mortification at what I had said." As he was sinking, however, Roe heard Johnson say, "I just went up to see that Tommy and Jim had everything they needed." Roe then understood, he says, why Johnson had barged in on them. So that he could say, "I just went up to see that Tommy and Jim." His feelings were confirmed after Johnson had returned to Washington in January 1956, and his affair with the good-looking girl became, in Corcoran's phrase, common knowledge around the Capitol. But Lady Bird had, years before at Longleat, learned to reconcile herself to this aspect of her husband's behavior, and she hadn't forgotten that lesson, as was proven during a conference among his physicians down at the ranch. Lady Bird was present, as was a single staff member, George Reedy, when the doctor again advised Johnson that he had to relax more, to do things he enjoyed, and Johnson told the doctors that he enjoyed nothing but whiskey, sunshine, and sex. Reedy found the moment poignant, he was to recall. Without realizing what he was doing, he had outlined succinctly the tragedy of his life. The only way he could get away from himself was sensation. Sun, booze, sex. It was quite clear, Reedy was to say, that Johnson was not talking merely about sex with his wife, and there was an embarrassed silence. It was broken by his wife speaking to the doctors in a calm voice. "Well, I think Lyndon has described it to you very well," she said. In later years, when more details of her husband's sexual affairs emerged, she would sometimes be asked about them. She finally evolved a stock reply. "Lyndon loved people," she would say. "It would be unnatural for him to withhold love from half the people." And the reply was always delivered with a smile. The other aspect of Lyndon Johnson's life that changed after his heart attack was his relationship with his staff, or at least the rages that had been a centerpiece of that relationship. Tension and anger were among the gravest threats to a heart attack victim, his doctors had warned him. Some causes of tension and anger would, to Lyndon Johnson, still be unavoidable, as would become apparent quite soon after his return to Washington. But anger at subordinates was not one of them. Some of his obscenity-laced tirades at his assistants and secretaries had been rages into which he deliberately worked himself as a means of control. There were other methods, simple ones, of controlling subordinates, and more he used these instead. Other tirades, not planned, had simply reflected a refusal to control himself. Now, with anger at subordinates a luxury he could no longer afford, indulgence in that luxury was reduced, quickly and effectively. "He became less hard to get along with," Walter Jenkins says. "Up to that time, when things didn't go just to suit him, he had a tendency to fly off the handle, at little things. It seemed to me that he was able to ignore these things more after the heart attack." Not that the rages ended. There were, at intervals, still the sudden, vicious, obscenity-filled explosions. Men and women who had not known the pre-heart attack Lyndon Johnson would still, witnessing one of these explosions, say they had never seen anything like it. Fearsome though they were, however, they were not the rages of old. There was a reduction in frequency, in duration, and in intensity. While they had lost nothing of their viciousness and ability to hurt, their relative quietness made them less emotionally draining. Now he had to control himself, and he did, John Connolly says. In those early days he would be just wild, raging, ranting, screaming, totally out of control. Now you could almost see him sometimes checking himself, reining himself in, as if he was saying, "I'm not going to have a heart attack over George Reedy." Chapter 29. The Program with the Heart. On the opening day of the 1956 session of Congress, 91 senators were at their desks when, after the chaplain's prayer, the majority leader rose to ask for recognition so that he could request a quorum call. Before Vice President Nixon gave him the floor, however, he said, The chair knows that he expresses the heartfelt sentiments of all the members of this body when he says that we are most happy to see the senator from Texas back in his accustomed seat. All along the four arcs of desks, senators stood and applauded. "You don't know how glad I am to stand at this desk again," Lyndon Johnson said quietly. After the quorum call had begun, he walked out to the lobby to pose for photographers. Nixon came out and put his arm around him. Walter George and Harry Byrd crowded up to him, not to get into the picture, but to say hello, and Theodore Francis Green was not far behind. As they talked to Lyndon, the old men's faces lit up, and their eyes were warm behind their thick glasses. Hubert Humphrey bustled over to shake his hand, with a broad, warm smile on his face, and it was no broader than Bill Nolan's. When, later that week, the Democratic Policy Committee held its first meeting, Johnson began by expressing his everlasting gratitude to Earl Clements and all the committee members for carrying on so admirably during his illness. "It was a labor of love for all of us," Clements replied, and the heads around the table, Jim Murray's and Lister Hill's and Bob Kerr's and Carl Hayden's, as well as Dick Russell's, nodded vigorously in agreement. Lyndon Johnson, who had spent his life searching for affection and a sense of security, was back in a place where he had found as much of those commodities as he was ever likely to find anywhere. He had just spent 5 months in the valley in which he had been born and raised, but he was back in a place, on a hill, that was much more a home to him than the Pernalis had ever been. Speaking at the Women's National Press Club Welcome to Congress dinner in the Hotel Statler that evening, tall and rangy, his deeply bronzed face dramatic above the black and white of his evening clothes, Johnson said that his heart attack had been a wonderful way to gain a little perspective. "I think I learned lessons of humility and of proportions, when to put forth the maximum effort and when to let troubles go by." Assuring reporter John D. Morris of the New York Times that he was going to follow his doctor's orders, he said, "I'm going to be sensible. I'm not going to try to do everything." James H. Roe, the highly respected lawyer and political insider who had known Lyndon Johnson for almost 20 years, was aware that, as he was to say, Johnson would always use whatever he could to make people feel sorry for him, because that helped him get what he wanted from them. But that awareness didn't help Roe when the person from whom Johnson wanted something was him. Johnson had been trying for years to acquire Roe's full-time services. He was aware of something known to very few people in Washington. Capitol legend had bestowed much of the credit for Harry Truman's 1948 victory on a memorandum written to the president before the campaign, at a time when his chances appeared hopeless. The memo proposed a campaign strategy, and it did so with great specificity and pragmatism. Every one of its recommendations was based not on ideology, but on what the memo called the politically advantageous thing to do. Truman had reputedly kept the document, 32 single-spaced typewritten pages, in the bottom drawer of his desk all during the campaign, using it as a blueprint for his come-from-behind victory. The memo, which had acquired an almost talismanic significance in the Capitol's political circles, had been presented to the president by Clark Clifford, his legal counsel, and its authorship was publicly attributed to him. But Johnson knew that except for some editing changes, the author was actually Roe. Having read the memo, and having observed how closely Truman adhered to its strategy, Johnson believed that the president had relied on it heavily, and that its brilliance had been proven by Truman's victory. He felt that Roe could do the same for him, could give him, too, a blueprint for reaching the goal that flickered always before him. He had, George Reedy was to say with more than a touch of envy, an almost mystical belief in Jim's powers. He thought Jim might make him Pope or God knows what. But while Roe had always been available to help Johnson with advice, having observed how Johnson treated people on his payroll, he had always rejected Johnson's offers to join his staff. During that first week in January, however, Johnson renewed his overtures with a new argument, and when Roe refused this time, he wouldn't let it drop. "I wish you would come down to the Senate and help me," he said in a low, earnest voice. And when Roe continued to refuse, using his law practice as an excuse, "I said I can't afford it, I'll lose clients," He found that Johnson was telling other members of their circle how cruel it was of Jim to refuse to help to take a little of the load off a man at death's door. People I knew were coming up to me on the street, and saying, "Why aren't you helping Lyndon? Don't you know how sick he is? How can you let him down when he needs you?" Johnson had spoken to Rowe's law partner, Rowe found. To my amazement, Corcoran was saying, "You just can't do this to Lyndon Johnson." I said, "What do you mean I can't do it?" He said, "Never mind the clients, we'll hold down the law firm." Johnson had spoken to Rowe's wife. One night Elizabeth turned on me. "Why are you doing this to poor Lyndon?" Then Lyndon Johnson came to Jim Rowe's office again to plead with him, crying real tears as he sat doubled over, his face in his hands. He wept. "I'm going to die. You're an old friend. I thought you were my friend, and you don't care that I'm going to die. It's just selfish of you, typically selfish." Finally, Rowe said, "Oh, God damn it, all right." And then, as soon as Lyndon got what he wanted, Rowe was forcibly reminded why he had been determined not to join his staff. The moment the words were out of Rowe's mouth, Johnson straightened up, and his tone changed instantly from one of pleading to one of cold command. "Just remember," he said, "I make the decisions. You don't." Throughout the 1956 session, Johnson used his heart attack to get what he wanted from senators, too. Bobby Baker would remind senators, recalcitrant on one issue or another, that they shouldn't upset the leader, that he was a sick man, that they should try to make things easier for him. Arguments that had particular resonance in 1956, for a group in which that year the shadow of death was particularly dark. In February, Harley Kilgore died of a stroke, and in April, Alban Barkley, giving a speech at a college in Virginia, had just proclaimed in one of his trademark religious references, "I would rather be a servant in the house of the Lord than sit in the seats of the mighty," when he clutched his chest, collapsed, and died of a heart attack. And all through that year, Eugene Milliken, once tall and vigorous but now pale and gaunt, was forced to attend Senate sessions in a wheelchair because of an illness that he called arthritis, but that his colleagues suspected was something worse. In July, Milliken announced that he would not seek re-election that November. Johnson did indeed act like a heart patient for a while, following his doctor's orders. He took a nap in the mid-afternoon, on the couch, either in G-14 or in Skeeter Johnston's inner office, or occasionally in the marble room, with an aide stationed outside the door to make sure he wasn't disturbed. Because the ordinary sofa was too short for him to stretch out, he had Senate cabinet maker Renzo Vanni make a number of new couches, 7 feet long, extra wide, so big that Vanni called them battleship couches. One, called by others the Johnson couch, remains in the marble room to this day. And for a while these naps were not to be interrupted. He would tell Skeeter's assistant, Dorothy Scott, how soon to call him, and tell her he wasn't to be disturbed until then. But only for a short while. After a week or two, when he came through Skeeter's outer office, Miss Scott recalls, he would walk in his great big strides like an antelope, and by the time he would get from my outer office into the inner office, he would have said about 7 things he wanted me to do. And long before the time he had told Miss Scott to wake him, the door to the inner office would burst open, and he would stride out, asking her if the things had been done. More and more days were uninterrupted by any nap at all. Clemens was in trouble in Kentucky, where he would have to stand for re-election in November against a very popular Republican, tall, handsome Assistant Secretary of State Thruston Morton. By February, the assistant leader was spending a lot of time back home, and Johnson asked George Smathers to be acting whip. The suave Floridian knew Johnson the senator, but he didn't know Johnson the boss, and he quickly found out that, as he was to put it, Johnson was very, very difficult to work for. Senator though he might be, Smathers found himself treated as if he were a member of Johnson's staff, and he learned that when Johnson gave an assignment, no excuses were accepted. He used to say, "I want only can-do people." That was one of his favorite expressions. "I want only can-do people around. I don't want anybody who tells me that they can't do something." If the assignment was to obtain a senator's vote, Johnson was very unsympathetic if that vote was not forthcoming. once, Quentin Burdick didn't vote like Johnson wanted. Why didn't you get on that goddamn you so-and-so and so-and-so 2 weeks ago? And the assignments never stopped coming. He demanded not just 100% of your time, but more than that, Smathers recalls. Every morning, early, Lyndon came by my house on Garfield Street, and I was with him until 10:30 at night. As soon as we walked into the Capitol, he started his 60-cylinder engine, and he didn't slow up during the entire workday. He wanted Smathers to be available until he left for home, and then it seemed like only a few hours later that Lyndon and his limousine were back at my front door to start a new day. There was no time to nap or to slow down, because the first major business Lyndon Johnson put before the Senate, within 3 weeks after the session began, was the part of his program with a heart that he considered the most significant for his political future. That proposal he had tried to conceal in the middle of the program so that no one would notice it. During the 6 years that had passed since 1949, the Senate's refusal to advise and consent to the reappointment of Leland Olds had had the desired effect on the Federal Power Commission. Olds's replacement by the malleable Mon Walgren meant that three of the FPC's 5 members were consistently reluctant to stand between the wealthy natural gas producers and the still greater wealth they coveted. Understandably reluctant, in Paul Douglas's view. All know the great pressure which has been exerted by the big producers on the commission, and the punishment which has been meted out to those who took an opposite stand, Douglas wrote in 1956. Since this is a real world, it is not to be wondered at that the majority of the commission have chosen to play it safe. Not only had the FPC reversed, one by one, the policies and regulations that Olds had promulgated to moderate the producers' greed, it had even taken the stance that its jurisdiction did not extend to the independent producers who sold gas to the pipeline companies, a stance which allowed the producers to claim steadily higher costs and to charge steadily higher rates. And when House liberals moved to formally give it that jurisdiction, the commission declined to accept it. During those 6 years, therefore, the price of natural gas had risen and risen again, from 6 cents per 1,000 cubic feet of gas in 1949 to 10 cents in 1955, and so had the profits of the natural gas companies and the price of their stock. A share of Superior Oil Company stock sold for $150 in 1949. In 1956, it was selling for exactly $1,000 per share. Since the Keck family owned 21,977 shares of Superior stock, it was easy to calculate the value of their holdings, $21,977,000. As for Herman and George Brown's Texas Eastern Transmission, a share of its stock, priced at $12 in 1949, was selling for $28 in 1955, which meant that the holdings of the two brothers, only a small share, of course, of their overall assets, was worth $8,379,000. In 1954, however, the states of Michigan and Wisconsin, whose residents and factories constituted the captive market of gigantic Phillips Petroleum, were paying almost 40% more for natural gas than in 1949, took the FPC to court to force it to give consumers the protection that Franklin Roosevelt had created it to give them, and the Supreme Court, holding for the states, specifically ordered the agency to accept jurisdiction over the independent producers and regulate their rates. Responding to this verdict as slowly as it dared, the FPC issued its decisions on rate applications so slowly that they caused what Fortune called the biggest logjam in the history of any federal regulatory agency. Delayed though regulation might be, however, it was coming, unless something was done about the court ruling. Legislation was needed to supersede it. In October 1954, therefore, the country's largest oil companies formed 2 committees. The activities of one, the Natural Gas and Oil Resources Committee, would be public, an advertising and public relations campaign to create support for the legislation. The committee would spend $1,753,000 during 1955 to educate the public. The activities of the other committee, budget and expenditures kept tightly concealed, were more private. Its educational efforts were directed not at the public, but at members of Congress. It was formed, as a memorandum by the committee's attorneys was to explain, for this express purpose. The funds for the lobbying carried out by this General Gas Committee were collected under the direction of another figure from the Olds hearings, Lyndon Johnson's old ally Maston Nixon of Corpus Christi, president of the Southern Minerals Corporation, and were distributed by two principal lobbyists, Johnson's former administrative assistant John Connolly and Elmer Patman, a loud, arrogant attorney from Austin, Texas, who was on Superior Oil's payroll. Early in 1955, a bill was introduced by Arkansas Representative Orrin Harris to, in effect, nullify the Supreme Court decision by exempting independent producers from FPC regulation. And on July 28, 1955, after extensive lobbying by both public and private committees, it was passed, 209-203, by the House of Representatives. A companion bill, introduced by Arkansas Senator Fulbright, was reported out of the Senate Commerce Committee that same day. Bringing the Harris-Fulbright natural gas bill to the Senate floor would angrily divide Democratic senators. The resulting split would run along geographic rather than the usual ideological lines. Senators from the gas-producing southwestern and western states were adamantly in favor of deregulation. Senators from the gas-consuming northern and eastern states adamantly opposed. The intra-party floor fight would be bitter, for not only were Democratic liberals against the measure, so were some of the party's many conservative senators, because the injustice was too raw for them. More than 70% of America's natural gas was owned by only 42 companies, many of which were controlled by a small, often overlapping group of individuals like Richardson, Murchison, Abercrombie, the Kecks, and the Brothers Brown. It was this small group that was reaping, at the expense of more than 21 million families, most of them middle or lower class, enormous, almost unimaginable profits. If there could be said to exist a national interest in natural gas regulation, it most certainly lay on the side of the consumers, not the producers. The producers, in addition, possessed a virtual monopoly over a natural resource which should, in the last analysis, belong to the people as a whole. And in the absence of federal regulation, the monopoly would only grow stronger, and the consumers would be only more and more defenseless against it. Millions of urban families owned gas-powered stoves, hot water heaters, and furnaces. Purchasing new appliances run on other fuels would be expensive, too expensive for most of them. Once the lines are laid, the homes hooked into the utility systems and the cooking and heating appliances bought, the chance for the users of gas to get any real protection against unfair producers' prices by competition is nil, Walter Goodman said. Speaking for the mayors of 50 American cities, Philadelphia's Mayor Joseph Clark told a Senate committee, "To eliminate controls is to leave the consumer at the mercy of a small group of oil companies." The Southerners, on whose support Lyndon Johnson could usually rely, were split. Brown and Root's Posh Oltorf would never forget his surprise when he learned that Lyndon was having as much trouble with the conservatives as with the liberals, with Russell as much as Humphrey. They, leading conservative senators, were opposed to it, the natural gas bill. They were for free enterprise, but this was just too much. They thought it was terrible. They thought it was a damned bonanza for the oil companies. We had a terrible time with Russell and Byrd. I remember my shock that they would be opposed to something for businessmen. The stakes involved in passage of the bill were huge, however. Estimates of the short-term increases in gas prices that could be expected following its passage ranged between $200 million and $400 million per year, an increase that would boost the values of the producers' gas reserves by between $12 and $30 billion. In expectation of passage, immense quantities of gas were being held off the market so that it could be sold at higher prices. Divisive though the bill would be, Lyndon Johnson's cherished unity had to be sacrificed to higher considerations. To win the Democratic presidential nomination, he would have to become friendlier with Northern liberals, and his principal financiers, rabid reactionaries almost to a man, would not ordinarily tolerate that. But the natural gas bill could be the key to greater tolerance, for these Texas tycoons held huge natural gas reserves. As the astute Oltorff was to explain, this, the natural gas bill, transcended ideology. This would put something in their pocket. That's how they viewed politics. Any son of a bitch who makes me $1 million can't be all bad. As long as you put dollars in their pockets, they'd forgive your ideology. Divisive though the Harris-Fulbright bill might be, therefore, in 1955 Lyndon Johnson had only been waiting for it to be passed by the House before bringing it to the Senate floor and passing it. With a majority of Democratic senators against the bill, he would have to pass it, over the wishes of his own party, with Republican votes. And he had been intending to do just that, with the support of Eisenhower, who firmly believed that the measure would liberate businessmen from unwarranted governmental restrictions. Johnson didn't want these arrangements upset by his heart attack. When Acting Majority Leader Clements visited him at the Bethesda Medical Center in July 1955, Johnson expressed himself, as Clements reported to the Democratic Policy Committee upon his return from the hospital, very frankly. He, Johnson, would like the bill taken up yesterday and passed the day before yesterday. Clements was not the man for so difficult a job, as he himself appears to have recognized. Telling the policy committee that opponents were ready for extended discussion, he betrayed a lack of confidence that the bill could be passed without Johnson's personal participation in the fight, saying, "In January we will have back with us our distinguished friend from Texas. He will be back with us strong. I will be happy to have it come up as early as possible in January." The committee agreed that that would probably be best. Now, Johnson was back, strong. Opposition within his party had filtered into even his rubber-stamp policy committee. Trying to show, as he put it in a committee meeting on January 5, 1956, that "I wanted to lean over backwards so I could not be accused of ramming the bill down the throats of the Senate," he had invited the leading proponents and opponents of the natural gas bill to make their case before the committee, and Paul Douglas made the opposition case with his usual eloquence. The bill, Douglas said, shouldn't be passed or even introduced under Democratic sponsorship. In 1954, Douglas said, one of the most effective Democratic issues against the Republicans had been the giveaway to big business. "If the bill comes out under Democratic sponsorship," he said, "it is going to deprive our presidential, senatorial, and congressional candidates of our strongest arguments. If any Democratic speaker talked about giveaway favors to big business, it would be thrown back in his face. This might well be a factor in our losing control of committees in both houses." Johnson tried to counter that argument, but as usual when he confronted Douglas in argument, he did not get the better of the exchange. Senator Johnson said he had heard that, Douglas's viewpoint expressed strongly in the Tidelands argument, but it didn't seem to have that effect on the 1954 elections, the Policy Committee minutes report. Senator Douglas replied that the Tidelands bill was brought up under Republican leadership. Conceding that the majority of the Policy Committee was probably against the natural gas bill, Johnson said, the only question was whether it should be brought up. "Was there any objection to bringing it to the floor?" he asked. "I won't object, but I want to say that it will be very unfortunate in my state," Hennings of Missouri replied. 5 of the 9 committee members hadn't said a word during the discussion, and the committee finally looked where it always looked for direction. When Senator Russell said his memory was that in July the committee had agreed that it would be brought up as early as possible in January, the committee agreed that it could be brought up. It was time for the first team. They, the oil men, sent their best men up, Posh Oltorff was to recall, in the tone of a Texas Homer relating the story of an historic battle. Across the crowded lobby of the Mayflower Hotel, a big hand with 2 missing fingers waved to a friend, and seeing that hand, lobbyist Dale Miller whispered in awe to a friend, "Ed Clark's here." To get the legendary secret boss of Texas to Washington, the humble oil company was paying him, in addition, of course, to the rent for his suite and all expenses, a fee of $1,000 per day, but, so that he wouldn't have to suffer the indignity of registering as a lobbyist, it was arranged, as he would recall, that although the humble was paying me, it would be paid through Brown and Root. a construction firm ostensibly unconnected with any legislation then before Congress. And Clark, of course, had his private incentive for winning the natural gas fight. Those 40,000 shares of Texas Eastern in his lockbox back in Austin. The broad-shouldered, big-bellied, squeaky-voiced, rumpled, coarse Clark was one of the two men the natural gas industry considered its most effective champions. The other, tall, slim, handsome, smoother than smooth, custom-tailored in pinstriped banker's blue, was also at the Mayflower. John Connolly had the entrees, Altorf would recall. He knew everybody from being on Johnson's staff, and everybody liked Connolly, and he could really get his side across. He knew how to talk to senators. He would say, "We'll never forget you. You will be doing a wonderful thing for your country, and I'll never forget it." And of course, that implies future support. The arrogant Patman had been supervising the General Gas Committee's lobbying efforts. He was informed that from now on he would be reporting to Connolly. Other lobbyists, not of the stature of a Clark or Connolly, but heroic figures in the Texas oil industry nonetheless, took the field in the natural gas battle of 1956. Charlie Francis, Colonel Ernest O. Thompson of the Texas Railroad Commission. "I remember seeing Colonel Thompson when I was a boy in a tent in an oil field in East Texas," Dale Miller would say. "And he was up there in Washington in 1956. Old and bent, but he was there." Robert Windfor of Dallas. Some wore into that battle the mantle of their fathers. Dale Miller's huge suite at the Mayflower, 377, had been the suite of his late father, Roy Miller of Texas Gulf Sulphur, an almost mythical lobbyist possessed of so much power in Washington that, the Saturday Evening Post said, for 20 years he has had the status of a quasi-public figure. The executive director of the Mid-Continent Oil and Gas Association, Claude Wilde Jr., a very canny young political string-puller, was the son of Claude Wilde Sr., the canny old Paul who had pulled strings for Lyndon Johnson's early campaigns in Texas. And all these men knew that this battle would be remembered in years to come. Talking with the author decades later, some of them tried to ensure that their participation in it would be recorded for history. Claude Wilde Jr. was discussing another matter when he interrupted himself to say, "You know, I was in charge of counting the votes for the natural gas bill." After a pause, he added, "You're not writing that down." And he waited until the author had made the desired note before continuing. During that battle, some of the oil men even came up to Washington themselves, staying at the Mayflower. "I saw Hunt there today," Texans told each other excitedly. "Sid's here, too. I saw him. And old man Keck in his wheelchair." George Brown, suave and discreet, was seldom seen. His suite was not at the Mayflower, but at the Hay Adams. And it was time for the captain of the team. Not only did Lyndon Johnson install Clark and Connolly in the Democratic Policy Committee office, at whoever's desk was vacant, Secretary Nadine Brammer recalls, so that they could make their telephone calls right out of the Capitol Rotunda, not only did he allow them to use his private office when face-to-face lobbying was needed, he also threw his weight behind them. "He, Johnson, would call senators up and ask them to come in and see me," Clark says. And Johnson made sure that senators knew that when Clark and Connolly spoke, they spoke for him. Johnson, of course, was lobbying himself, harder than anyone, Altorf says, as well as mapping strategy and directing the overall campaign.
End of Disc 28.